are interfering in the country's democratic process, including the prime minister. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this is the case and what Pakistan intends to do about its relation with the U.S. First, let's find out about all the developments that happened. Kamran Yusuf is our correspondent who joins us from Islamabad. Well, there's quite a bit of ground for you to cover for us here. If you can highlight what actually occurred today.
Well, it was quite an unprecedented and a tumultuous day in the history of Pakistan. And the National Assembly of Pakistan was supposed to vote on a no-confidence motion moved by the opposition parties, but the government had other ideas. When the session started, the country's law minister stood up and stated that the speaker should not allow the vote of no confidence take place, since the government believes that this vote of no confidence was part of a foreign conspiracy to topple the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan, since according to the government, he was pursuing an independent foreign policy. And after listening to the law minister's remarks, the deputy speaker of the National Assembly, who happens to be the member of the ruling party, declared that this move by the opposition parties was not in line with the constitution, and hence he dismissed and did not allow opposition to vote on the vote of no confidence, although opposition had the numbers to unseat Prime Minister Imran Khan. And after that, Prime Minister Imran Khan appeared on a national television and congratulated the nation for, what he said, defeating the conspiracy hatched by a foreign power. And then he advised President of Pakistan to dissolve the National Assembly and announce early election. And now the matter is before the Supreme Court of Pakistan, because opposition parties have challenged the ruling of the deputy speaker, because they think that the speaker had violated the constitutional provisions.
Thank you for that, Kamran Yusuf, correspondent there from Islamabad. We appreciate that. Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Liaghat Ali Khan. He's the author, academic, and researcher who joins us from Topeka, Kansas. Also joining us is Ashabir Rizvi, managing director of IFSA, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Liaghat Ali Khan, let me first start with you. In your assessment, what occurred in Parliament today was quite unprecedented, just like our correspondent there mentioned. Tell us about some of those developments, what you think it means, especially the fact that at this point we're looking at a Parliament that is dissolved, and then what we're looking at in terms of what the Prime Minister is promoting here.
Yes, thank you. Under the Constitution of Pakistan, when a no-confidence motion is in the National Assembly, the Prime Minister has no constitutional authority to dissolve the Assembly. And the Assembly must vote on the no-confidence motion. So today, on Sunday, this was the last day under the Constitution to vote on the no-confidence motion. But the Prime Minister, he has been arguing that the United States has given money and incentive and help to the opposition parties to overthrow his regime, because he has been very close to China and Russia. And I think there is some evidence that the United States is not happy with the Prime Minister, and they won't mind if the Prime Minister is deseated. So to that extent, I think Mr. Khan has a good case. But then he goes further and argues that about 10 political parties, some are very religious parties, some have been anti-American political parties, they all are conspiring with the United States to unseat him. And some 20 members of his own party, so there are like 200 members out of 342 who would like to de-seat the prime minister. So I think it's very difficult for people, particularly in the legal community, to accept the assertion that 200 members of the National Assembly and 9 or 10 political parties of Pakistan, they are, they are traitors, the word he uses, and they are trying to overthrow his government because they are conspiring with the United States. So I think what he did is completely, blatantly unconstitutional. And I think the Supreme Court of Pakistan would say so.
So in your opinion, you don't think that what he is claiming is true, the fact that you have all these party members actually cooperating with the U.S.?
I think I don't know if what he's saying is true or untrue. But that is not the way to resolve the problem.
Sure.
I think if the opposition is actually conspiring with the United States to de-seat him, he needs to produce irrebuttable evidence before some court of law to show that that is the case. Mere allegation that 200 members of the National Assembly and mere allegation that 9 political parties are conspiring with the United States to overthrow him, I think that's a big claim.
Right.
And there is no due process to the evidence. There's no due process to the counterclaim of the opposition parties that they are against Prime Minister Khan because his government is incompetent.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
Sure. Let's see what Shabir Rizvi thinks. Shabir Rizvi, we actually have something that's unprecedented, which I'd like to find out from you what you think about it, and that's the fact that you have the chance death to America that happened in Parliament, according to what we have received in reports. And also the fact that the National Assembly Deputy Speaker talking about how no foreign power should be allowed to topple an elected government through a conspiracy. I'm wondering if he's obviously making a reference there to the U.S. And, of course, your thoughts on the chants that were made in Pakistan's Parliament.
Hello. Thank you very much, Kaveh. It's good to be back. And best wishes in Ramadan for all of us. Now, look, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and I'm not an expert on the intricacies of the political parties in Pakistan. But I think what one has to really understand, whether Mr. Imran Khan is using the word conspiracy to strengthen his position or not, we have to look at a bit more in history. The first Prime Minister of Pakistan was assassinated by the CIA back in 1951. And continuously, the USA has interfered in Pakistan. And what one's got to understand is that both the two major parties, the Muslim League and also the Pakistan People's Party, they really have been quite corrupt in the last 30, 40 years in Pakistan. The elite in Pakistan have really impoverished Pakistan, especially the two political dynasties, as I said. So they don't really have a very good record. And I really like to sort of put this in the mix for Pakistani elite who have investments in UK and USA. You can see that what's happened in the last 4 weeks, that some of the oligarchs' assets have been taken over in the UK and their bank accounts have been frozen. I hope the Sharifs and the Zardaris and Mr. Bilawal Bhutto and his sister and Maryam Sharif also should take that into account, that sooner or later their assets will be frozen in the UK. Uh-huh. So whether they want to be traitors to Pakistan, their livelihood and their assets will be taken over by Britain as soon as they are not in the good books UK and USA.
Sure.
So, you know, the opposition is playing a very tightrope and delicate game themselves.
Okay, so there you have the view in terms of at least the view from our guest there from London, Lighat Ali Khan, about the opposition. But let's zoom in more on the accusations that has been leveled by Prime Minister Khan against the U.S. Now, based on what we have heard, one of the reasons that he believes the U.S. is behind what has happened in Parliament eventually with the no-confidence motion is because of his visit to Russia last month. Do you find that to be credible?
Yes.
Sorry,
I think the United States does not like that Pakistan, which has been an ally for the United States since its creation in 1947. So I think the United States is not happy, like it is not happy with many other countries that do not agree with the United States. And I think as a superpower, then the superpowers do that, whether it's Russia or China or the United States. They don't like small countries to have independent foreign policy. And I think Pakistan, Prime Minister Khan, he's saying that we want to have an independent foreign policy. Well, that's a very good idea. But the reality is that Pakistan is completely dependent on the West, whether it is the World Bank, whether it's the IMF, whether it is, the defense equipment, in so many ways.
Okay, so let me jump in there. Let me jump in there, Lighat Ali Khan. Ask Kamran Yusuf, ask Shabir Rizvi whether he agrees with you on that. Shabir Rizvi, is Pakistan, as much as the Prime Minister wants a foreign policy independent from the U.S. and the West, can it do that? Or based on what our guest said, that's just really an idea that can't be done?
Look, Pakistan, like many other countries on this planet, have been impoverished by their elite and also by the superpowers. Now, whether Russia, China, or America act similarly, the experience is that since partition, and particularly when Pakistan took the side of USA under the pretext of fighting terrorism 20 years ago under General Musharraf, that clearly shows that Pakistan has come out a loser. So, you know, the Mr. Sharif, who is the main opposition leader at this moment, says that Pakistan is a poor country and poor countries have no rights. I mean, how dare that a particular leader in Pakistan says that poor countries have no rights? Therefore, all poor countries should forget about it. And Iran, next door to Pakistan, is a very good example that for the last 43 years, it had stood up against Iran, against USA.
Right.
And of course, sanctions have blighted the nation. It has created all kinds of problems. But at the end of the day, whether the West dislikes Iran or not, they respect Iran.
Sure.
While Pakistan, because of its own leaders, has no respect in London, Paris, or Washington. And that's what I think Imran Khan and some of the other leaders are trying to sort of get Pakistan to be a respected nation and not to be a vassal of Washington.
Exactly. Lighat Ali Khan, to break this open more, based again on news that we have, Pakistan's ambassador to Washington actually said that he has recorded a senior U.S. official.
Hello.
Is for Lighat Ali Khan. Pakistan's ambassador.
Hello, I can't hear you.
To Washington, who has recorded a senior U.S. official telling him they felt relations would be better if Khan left office. I mean, that goes beyond not having a country aligned with your foreign policy, in the case of the U.S., to want Khan to leave office. Again, if this is true, which we believe that it is, do you think that is the way U.S. approaches it? Their track record speaks as such.
Absolutely. I think there's no doubt about that. All superpowers and even middle powers, they want to influence other nations. Actually, let me say it to you, not even the United States, the superpower, can pursue an independent foreign policy. This whole concept of independent foreign policy is passé. It's not valid. I think the nations are so mutually dependent that no country, no matter how strong, can pursue an independent foreign policy. So as a smart nation, not a foolish nation, as a smart nation, you have to see the enmeshment of the world. You have to understand that the world is no longer, you know, not united. It is united, sometimes in a pathological way, that we are dependent on each other, and there's hierarchy in the international community. So I think as a smart nation, you don't defy superpowers. You work with them, mm-hmm. and you make your case without destroying yourself. I think Saddam Hussein did that. Mr. Gaddafi did that. I think I would appreciate Iran is very smart. I think they fight in a beautiful way,
right?
In my view, that they resist, but they don't destroy their nation. And I think Pakistan should do the same.
Well, the problem is who makes a nation a superpower? The definition of that is where I think most of the problem is. So let me get to Shabir Rizvi here. Shabir Rizvi, let's really look at what has happened here when it comes to Imran Khan vis-a-vis the U.S. One of the problems that existed between the two, which was very big, was on the issue of Afghanistan. One of the tweets that Khan actually sent out was that to the U.S., said, "The U.S., we will be your friend, not your slave. We will help you withdraw from Afghanistan, but we will not launch military operation for you." That's just one of the stances of Imran Khan. So the U.S. obviously does not particularly care for Khan. Is that a correct conclusion to make on the relationship between Khan and the U.S.?
But look, it's becoming very clear that the direction that Imran Khan wants to take Pakistan, unlike the previous the two political parties that I talked about, they have really sold their soul very cheaply for their children to be educated in UK and USA and to buy properties in this part of the world. In reality, they've had no love for their nation as such, other than sort of lining their pockets. Coming back to the issue of our friend talking about that no nation has independent policy, yes, I tend to agree with him to a degree. However, independence means that trying to do things that are in the benefit of one's nation and people. Now, if that is the definition of being independent, fine. Otherwise, all nations have to work together. But what we have to really look at is the track record that the USA has in Pakistan and also globally, you know, whether it's sort of color revolutions in Ukraine that happened, as we know, or more recently in Kazakhstan and all over the place. And also assassinations are part of the baggage that USA carries. If they do not try to remove a leader by a color revolution or by other conspiratorial methods, then they assassinate. IND is a good example. Lumumba in Congo is a good example. And I can go on and on and on for another hour listing where USA has assassinated other leaders. China, as far as I know, hasn't done that in the last few odd years. As far as I know, Russia, even in the previous Soviet Union, hasn't done that. So the really...
Okay. These two countries that you mentioned, I'd like to come to Liaquat Ali Khan and ask him. Liaquat Ali Khan, we're looking at China's relationship with Pakistan. Obviously a very close relationship. The Belt and Road Initiative has given Pakistan quite a bit of investment within the country, which has been ongoing for quite some time. And obviously Pakistan has long enjoyed diplomatic and business relationships with China. Again, multi-billion dollar development deals that they have had. The U.S. obviously does not like that either. So if you put Russia and then put this next to each other, and of course the way that Prime Minister Imran Khan has criticized the U.S. in terms of the way they operated in Afghanistan and saying that Pakistan could have done more, again, more reason for the U.S. to, according to Imran Khan, want him out?
I think if you want to criticize the United States or any other superpower, you should be an academic. But if you are the prime minister of a country, or if you're the president of a country, then your criticism is within the bounds of pragmatism. then the interest of your country is superior to the morality of behavior. And I think this is where Mr. Khan, who himself has a very interesting background, he has been a playboy for many decades, and now, you know, he has a tasbih in his hand, and he is now, you know, peddling Islam. And I think he has every right to do so. But as the prime minister of a nuclear-powered country, whose economic power is very bad, he has to be pragmatic in his criticism, in his behavior, in his criticism of the United States particularly, mm-hmm. with which Pakistan has the highest international trade. And a lot of money comes from the United States in many forms. So simply from a pragmatic viewpoint, the prime minister cannot challenge the United States. And I think Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, when he detonated the nuclear bombs, President Clinton asked him not to do so. There was a lot of pressure on Nawaz not to detonate nuclear bombs, but he did. And I think at the same time, he was very understanding and very sort of polite to Pakistan, to the United States.
Sure. Well, let's examine the role, if we can here, Shabir Rizvi, of the Pakistani army, and whether there is a stance there that is diverging from the prime minister. Because hours before Prime Minister Khan spoke earlier today, the head of the army, General Qamar Javed Bajwa, had said that Pakistan wanted to expand its ties with Washington. So it seems like they don't want to jeopardize that relationship. Do you think that has to deal with the billions of dollars, maybe in military aid that the U.S., at least we know, has given Pakistan? Is that what this is about? Or why do you think that Pakistani army is keen on expanding its relation with Washington, I guess, diverging from the stance that Imran Khan has?
Well, you quite rightly point out that the army has a lot of support in Washington and has continued to enjoy armament deals and trade that have benefited the military extremely. However, I think the whole global dynamics in the last 4 weeks has changed so significantly that USA is a declining power, without any doubt. The whole issue of the dollar perhaps not being the reserve currency in the next 5 years or even earlier, and the relationship that is developing between Russia, Iran, and China. And the reality is that Pakistan is in the East. It's not in the West. Yes, it does trade with the West. Yes, it wants to have relationship with the West. But really, the future of Pakistan lies with the East.
I'll have to jump in. Give 30 seconds to Lirat Ali Khan. Lirat Ali Khan. I'm sorry, Shabir Rizvi. Lirat Ali Khan, 30 seconds. Where is Pakistan headed to now, given what has occurred? Are we looking at instability in that country? 30 seconds, please.
Yes, I think the Supreme Court would reverse what Imran Khan has done. They would restore the National Assembly, and Mr. Khan would be de-seated from prime ministership.
Okay, thank you. We'll leave it there. Lirat Ali Khan, author, academic, and researcher from Topeka, Kansas. Thank you for your thoughts. Shabir Rizvi, managing director at IFSA London, who spoke to us from London, and at the top of our program, Kamran Yusuf, a correspondent, spoke to us from Islamabad. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kaveh Tafawi, and the entire team is goodbye. Until the next time.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أرأيت من اتخذ إلهه هواه أفأنت تكون عليه وكيلا
Have you seen the one who takes as his God his own desire? Then would you be responsible for him?
As you have been previously with us, brothers and sisters, we were discussing the 43rd verse of chapter Furqan. أَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَهَهُ هَوَاهُ أَفَأَنْتَ تَكُونُ عَلَيْهِ وَكِيلًا Have you seen him who takes his low desires for his God? Would you then be a guardian over him? In this verse, any other God other than Almighty Allah is called Hawa, which is the root and the main root of all evil, specifically the root of idol worshipping, following low desires. So that is why Almighty Allah in this noble verse says that if you as my prophet are ridiculed, if you are stood against, if you see the people denying the call of you as my prophet, it is not because you might have a problem. It is not because you might have weak logic. It is not because your reasons are not convincing. It is not because your religion cannot be followed. It is merely because they are not obeying their reasons and intellects. It is because they have taken their low desires as their gods. So, this verse somehow concludes all the previous pretext-seeking of the polytheists, the pagans and unbelievers against the Prophet of Islam, and also the previous nations before the Prophet of Islam. They also had different pretexts not to accept the call of their messengers. But this verse concludes them all. أَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَهَهُ هَوَى Have you seen him who takes his low desires and his God, as his God? أَفَأَنْتَ تَكُونُ عَلَيْهِ وَكِيلًا Can you be a guardian over him?
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
فَبَدَا وَضِيئًا كَالنُّجُومِ تَأَلُّقًا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Dear listeners, undoubtedly there are various instincts, there are various desires in man. They are, of course, necessary for the continuance of his life. There are different desires. Anger, love, fury, self-loving, being fond of wealth and this material life, and such like. Certainly, system of creation has created all of these various desires in mankind for the sake of perfection. Now, what is important in this case is that sometimes they do not cut their coat according to their cloth and exceed the limit, which means they cannot be controlled sometimes. It means they will not be in the hand and control of mind. They begin to rebel and revolt. These desires sometimes imprison intellect and rule the whole entity of man, and they take him under their control. This is the same thing that is called worshipping low desires. This is what is sometimes referred to as sensuality, which is more dangerous than all kinds of idol worshipping. Even idol worshipping is also generated from it, as the verse says. أَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَهَهُ هَوَهُ. This is why the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, has counted idol of low desire as the worst and supreme idol, where he says, under the sun and before Allah, there is no greater idol than low desire that is worshipped. The Prophet of Islam sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam has also said elsewhere, the most disliked idol that is worshipped in the earth is the idol of low desire. If we think well about this sentence, we find out that worshipping low desire is the source of unawareness and ignorance, as the Holy Quran says, and do not obey him whose heart we have made neglectful of our remembrance, and he follows his own low desire and whose affair has become all excess. In the 28th verse of chapter Kahf, we read, وَلَا تُتِعْ مَنْ أَغْفَلْنَا قَلْبَهُ عَنْ ذِكْرِنَا وَاتَّبَعَ هَوَاهُ وَكَانَ أَمْرُهُ فُرُطًا. And his affair has become all excess. On the other hand, worshipping low desires is the source of paganism and faithlessness, as we said and we read earlier in the previous verses. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Some 2 million Gazans are observing another holy month of Ramadan under the Israeli blockade for the 16th time in a row. Muslims around the world enjoyed this holy month while people in Gaza struggled to observe it under inhuman conditions. People in the tiny coastal enclave have limited access to food and they are also denied the right to freedom of movement. During this holy month of Ramadan, most Gazans are impoverished as their incomes continue to dwindle because of the crippling Israeli blockade.
The situation in Gaza, especially during the holy month, is very difficult. Poverty and unemployment rates are very high, and people can hardly afford to buy food to prepare their meals and break their fasting.
People usually shop for food items to prepare their iftar meals a few hours before iftar time, which takes place at dusk. Gazans, meanwhile, find it very hard to prepare their fast-breaking iftar meals due to the harsh economic conditions.
Ramadan is a wonderful month, but people are having a hard time because of the Israeli blockade. There is no purchasing power, and most people just walk around the goods while hardly buying anything.
According to UN reports, the majority of people living in the Gaza Strip are receiving some sort of aid to survive. Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed, and poor people have been getting poorer year after year.
Israel work against the international law. The siege is continued at the time we are in the beginning of Ramadan. Blockade means poverty. Blockade means high average of unemployment.
Experts say the Israeli regime has been fueling misery and suffering in the tiny coastal sliver.
Thousands of Gazan families can't afford to buy food to prepare their Ramadan meals amid the dire economic situation. They mainly blame the suffering on the Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped. And the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for 2 flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, this latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation in their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Bnei Brak, one of Tel Aviv's suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Dia Hamashi from Yabet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues,
But this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, It is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria, headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoudeh Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its war on terror.
The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nikzad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The Saudi siege, a war crime and a genocide, is the title of the seventh official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report highlights the impact of the Saudi blockade on the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech when he said that we will not stand idly by and we will not allow this siege to come to Saudi Arabia and its allies, that we will use our right to respond. Any country has to protect its citizens. Therefore, I believe that the coming days are fraught with surprises. Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen and prevents the entry of food, medicine, and fuel, and this is genocide.
Officials say the Saudi-led coalition has committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 7 years of war. They also say Riyadh's breach of international law is covered up politically by the United Nations.
We've entered the eighth year. Saudi-led coalition is still committing war crimes against Yemenis, especially the siege, which takes more lives than airstrikes. Public services, especially the health sector, have been greatly affected by the lack of fuel, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients. Unfortunately, the United Nations provides the political cover-up for the illegal acts of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations describes war-torn Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but has taken no action to end this humanitarian catastrophe.
Observers say Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
the Iranian flag was hoisted high in Tehran on a day that's remembered as a milestone in Iran's history. April 1, 1979 was a day when the Islamic Republic replaced 3 millennia of monarchy in Iran. This came in a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots contained yes or no to the Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose to vote yes.
April 1st is the Islamic Republic Day. It was a day when the monarchy gave way to democracy. We as Iranians honor this major occasion and celebrate it every year.
The Islamic Republic blessed Iran with independence and self-reliance. Today, Iran has its own industry and economy, which are not reliant on foreign countries.
The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations. Trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and well-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment, but because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures. The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In the limelight.
Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned but also opposed practically, says Khadija Ali, journalist, in an article titled "Islamophobia, the Last Form of Racism in the World." Stay tuned for more. Discrimination based on color, race, ethnicity, or religion is repugnant and must not only be condemned, but also opposed practically. There are numerous United Nations General Assembly resolutions affirming concrete action against racial or other forms of discrimination. Yet, Islamophobia continues to rage and exacts a heavy toll of innocent Muslims in many parts of the world, including Canada. One particular UNGA resolution proposed that the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination be observed annually. It coincides with the day the white police force in South Africa opened fire and killed 69 blacks in Sharpeville in 1960. They were holding a peaceful demonstration against apartheid passed laws. South Africa was then under apartheid rule. It ended in 1992 and South Africa elected its first black president, Nelson Mandela, in 1994. In 1979, the General Assembly adopted a program of activities to be undertaken during the second half of the decade for action to combat racism and racial discrimination. The UNGA decided that a week of solidarity with the peoples struggling against racism and racial discrimination, beginning on March 21st, would be organized annually in all states. There is even an